So to remind you what we talked about last time, we were talking about scales and units, and we sort of ended by noting that there are four fundamental constants: speed of light, h bar, g Newton, and Boltzmann's constant. And there are four quantities that we might be interested in: length, time, energy, and temperature. And if we use E equals mc squared, then mass and energy are sort of the same thing. So I'll just lump those together. So if I have these four fundamental constants and these four quantities that I could be interested in measuring, then there is a way to combine these four things into these four constants and these four quantities so that I can write everything in terms of dimensionless numbers. And there were these sort of intermediate steps along the way that we talked about. So the first one was, okay, well, we could set the speed of light. We could use the speed of light, set it to 1, which effectively means that lengths and times were the same thing. And then there was the other intermediate step, which was particle physicist units, which said that h bar equals c equals 1. And that implied that, well, lengths are times are inverse energies are inverse masses. And we chose a pseudo-fundamental thing to measure everything in terms of, which was a GeV. And we chose that because that's the mass of a proton. And that's sort of something that you can imagine is pseudo-fundamental, because an alien in a distant galaxy, whether or not he cares to contact us, can still measure the mass of a proton and get the same thing that we get. Okay, so there was GeV. And then additionally, if we add temperature to the mix, then all these length, time, inverse energy, inverse mass, inverse temperature are all the same thing, and we measure them all in terms of GeV. Okay, so that brings us to Planck units. Where I'll do what I advertised. Okay, so now additionally, you can guess what we do. We set g Newton equals to 1. And so g Newton has units of length cubed, mass, time squared. And so g Newton in the intermediate language, so according to particle physicists, has units of 1 over energy squared, or mass squared, you take your pick. So g Newton we could measure in terms of inverse GeV squared, for example. Okay, but we could also think about it in terms of these completely dimensionless units. And so from the four fundamental constants, we can then define four quantities. So the Planck mass, the so-called Planck mass, this is h bar c cubed over, g Newton. So what's this? That's energy times time. And then here we've got length cubed over time cubed. So putting these together, we get energy times length cubed over time squared, and that's the same thing as g Newton. Okay, work it out if you don't believe me. Okay, so from here we're going to get an energy squared. So that will have units of energy squared. So that will define as a Planck mass. And then we can define a Planck length using these. So g Newton h bar over c cubed. Oh, and I guess we should say what these are. So in terms of our favorite unit, GeV, for energies, this is 1.2, sorry, numerics are getting fuzzy in my head, GeV. So the Planck mass is 1.2 times 10 to the 19 GeV. It's an absolutely huge number. Planck length is in meters of 1.6 times 10 to the minus 35 meters. And then we can define a Planck time and a Planck temperature. So Planck time is just, now we can use C, that's L Planck over C, and this is 5.4 times 10 to the minus 44 seconds. And then finally a temperature, T Planck, and that's gonna be M Planck over the Boltzmann's constant, because that's what takes us from an energy to a temperature. And that's 1.4 times 10 to the 32 degrees Kelvin. Okay, so now if I want to make dimensionless units out of anything, I just divide by the appropriate quantity, right? So so what's the mass of a proton? Well, that's going to be 1 GeV over M Planck. So so basically 1 times 10 to the minus 19. And I don't have to attach any units. That's the mass of the proton if I use Planck units. And so on and so forth. So so that's convenient. In these units, everything is dimensionless. And this is sort of the preferred units. Say in string theory, quantum gravity, anything that involves quantum gravity. Okay, so why is that? Why are these the preferred units of quantum gravity? Yeah, that's the broken one. Okay, so a few preliminary remarks. About quantum gravity and what this has to do with these Planck units. So let's think about the gravitational potential. So if I have two masses, M1 and M2, then this is going to be that familiar result. And so if you like, this is classical. This is classical gravity. Doesn't matter if I'm talking about general relativity or Newton. If I'm looking at small scales, then GR tells me that this is also the gravitational potential. Okay, so I don't need to worry about a distinction between Newton and GR. This is just the classical gravitational potential. And in pictures, we think about this as if I have two particles, M1 and M2, in a quantum mechanical sense, these things can exchange a spin 2 particle called a graviton, and then that mediates a force. It mediates the gravitational force. So this picture and Newtonian gravity are equivalent. And you'll learn how when you talk about quantum field theory, but you know, just in pictures, schematically, that's what's going on. Okay, so now I want to ask, there's no H bar here, so there's no quantum mechanics. So at the level of quantum mechanics, what do the corrections to the Newtonian potential look like? And just sort of by dimensional analysis, you can imagine I'm going to get maybe extra powers of G Newton, because G Newton tells me more or less how strong this force is going to be. And G Newton has to do with the square of the Planck length, right? So Planck length squared is proportional to G Newton. So if I had to guess, just by dimensional analysis, then I should have a correction here that goes something like L Planck over R squared. Okay, so why is that? Basically, it's the right units. It involves G Newton, and it involves H bar, which is the thing that tells me that this is quantum mechanics. Yeah.
But does that have unit 1 L Planck over R squared? Or should there be a square?
Oh yeah, sorry, I meant to square. Thanks.
So if I had to guess, I would write down something that looks like this, where there's some number in front. And so in pictures, what this would look like is now, instead of just having a single graviton go between these two things and mediate a force, I have to start considering things called loops. Okay, so whenever I have a loop, that implies there's a virtual particle, which implies quantum mechanics, which implies I should consider an H1. Of course, you would all say, no, this is wrong, because we know that this is the reason we invented quantum gravity in the first place, because the answer to this, if I evaluate the amplitude, is infinity. And that's true. That's true. So you'll also, in quantum field theory, learn about a concept called renormalization. And so if I just have one loop, and I don't consider all the possible corrections, so all the possible powers of L Planck squared over R squared, then if I just have one loop, I can make this finite by subtracting off an infinite piece. Now, unfortunately for gravity, there's no consistent way to do that for all the different numbers of corrections in H bar. And so I can do it for one loop, but then I have to invent a new procedure at two loops, and I have to invent a new procedure at three loops, and there's no consistent way to make this infinity go away at all loops. But nevertheless, I should be able to estimate what the first correction is at one loop, and you know, I don't need to know the theory of quantum gravity to know that Newtonian gravity should work, at least in some heuristic sense, on large enough scales. So if we just consider this first correction, then we can subtract off the infinity, and it looks something like this. But what you see here is, if this is anything like a power series in powers of L Planck squared over R squared, as soon as I start talking about distances that are smaller or of order L Planck, then that series will not converge, right? And I really have to worry about these corrections becoming important. Okay? So that's where, basically, we see, that's one sort of heuristic, hand-wavy way of seeing that, you know, when R becomes of order L Planck, you need quantum gravity. And equivalently, when you know, energies become of order M Planck, or times become of order T Planck, I should start to worry about the same things, because maybe I want to compute some other thing that has to do with times, or some other thing that has to do with energies. And these are going to be corrected in a similar way. Just by dimensional analysis, I can imagine doing a similar thing. Okay, so here we enter the regime of quantum gravity, and you guys will take a course on quantum gravity, and you'll learn a lot more about the details here. And if you want to do string theory, you can take a course on string theory and learn about a possible resolution to these infinities. Okay, but let's just look at this, and again, look at the numbers. So if I want to reach the quantum gravity regime, I need to look at lengths that are smaller than 10 to the minus 35 meters. So you probably are not ever going to care about that. We're never going to reach that in an experiment. So here we are kind of in theory land. If you want energies, you need to reach energies of 10 to the 19 GeV, you know, which is about 16 orders of magnitude higher than the energies probed in the LHC. But we do care about quantum gravity and cosmology, actually, very much. The reason being, if we extrapolate back in time, in an expanding universe, things get hotter and denser. And eventually, unless something happens, we do reach a regime where you sort of care about these effects. You reach energies, you reach temperatures, you reach length scales that you care about that are sort of squarely in this quantum gravity regime. And so, you know, part of understanding the Big Bang and part of understanding, say, what happened right after the Big Bang, like this theory of cosmic inflation that you'll also learn about, you know, you do sort of care about this. Things are sensitive to quantum gravity. Okay, so now we could ask, like, well, okay, that's kind of strange. So I have, you know, one, on the one hand, one TeV, and that more or less characterizes the standard model of particle physics. And then all the way over here in energy, I've got the Planck scale. And there's a huge distance in energy between these two quantities. That has a name. That's called the hierarchy problem. So why is it that the energy scale is characterizing the standard model, which has to do with the electromagnetic weak forces, and the energy scales that characterize quantum gravity? You know, why are these two scales so enormously different? And so this is sort of related to, if we think about forces and potentials and things that that we cover in undergraduate physics, has to do basically with the weakness of the gravitational force. And this is a really incredibly fundamental property of our universe, because if it wasn't so weak, then we wouldn't be able to understand the standard model of particle physics without understanding quantum gravity, which is hard. So, you know, again, just like the fact that perturbations are really small on the largest scales in the universe allows us to do cosmology, the hierarchy problem is not really a problem, it's a feature of our universe. And it's a feature of our universe that allows us to do physics, period. Like, we would really be in the dark if this was not true. And the universe would look extraordinarily different. So, how weak exactly is the gravitational force? So let's say I have an electron, another electron, or a positron, it doesn't matter. So we can measure the strength of the electromagnetic force, again, in a dimensionless sense. So we can write the Coulomb force between these two electrons, say yesterday, 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, e squared over r squared. We can write this in terms of a dimensionless thing, a alpha. So this is going to be alpha, which again was 1 over 137, divided by r squared, if we use our fancy particle physics units where C is H bar is 1. Okay, so alpha is more or less a dimensionless measure of the strength of the electromagnetic force. And alpha is 1 over 137. So not too small of a number. So in gravity, we can do this for sort of in a particle-specific way. Okay, so for electrons, we can characterize the gravitational force. We can invent some dimensionless number alpha g, which is going to be g newton times the square of the mass of the electron over 4 pi h bar c, okay, where, again, now you could recognize here, we're going to get something with units of 1 over mass squared. We've just written m Planck, and then we've got mass squared. So this is 1 over 4 pi times the mass of the electron over m Planck squared. And if we would evaluate what that number is, it's 2 times 10 to the minus 45. So that's a sort of dimensionless way of thinking about the characteristic strength of gravity between two electrons. And it's incredibly, incredibly tiny. Okay, so now we could ask, oh well, how do these compare? So what is the force of gravity between these two electrons over the Coulomb force? And that's just going to be a ratio of these two numbers, alpha g to alpha. And that's going to be something like 10 to the minus 42. So the electromagnetic force is 10 to the 42 times bigger than the gravitational force. So this is an enormous hierarchy. And you can see why. The reason that this hierarchy is so big is basically because of this ratio. Because the electron has a mass that is so much smaller than the Planck mass, right? And so, you know, it's really the sort of lightness of particles that gives rise to the fact that gravity is such a weak force compared to electricity and magnetism. Now, you know, we can imagine these forces being equal. So we can ask, at what energy are these forces equal? So these forces are equal, you know, basically if the Planck mass was equal to a MeV. So let's think about if that was true, if there was no hierarchy between the electromagnetic and the gravitational forces, then the scale of quantum gravity is an MeV. So that means I wouldn't be able to understand nuclei without understanding quantum gravity. You know, you can thank the existence of chemistry. Like, if we want to get really fundamental, chemistry exists because the mass of the electron is so much lighter than the Planck mass. The mass of any particle in the Standard Model is so much lighter than the Planck mass. So that's a really important feature of our universe. Okay, now we're going to change gears. So before I change gears, are there any questions about any of the stuff I just did? Okay, so that's poor man's quantum gravity, and you're going to learn real quantum gravity in detail in the courses. So now we're going to move on to talk about GR, relativity.
Do any people try to explain the hierarchy problem? I mean, like, it seems like just how nature it is, but like, it is how, why people name it as a problem.
Ah, okay. So it's a problem because if I ask what is the effect of this in the Standard Model of particle physics? These same loop corrections that I talked about that correct the gravitational potential, they also correct the masses of particles. And if I have a scalar particle like the Higgs boson, then the correction from gravity to the mass of the Higgs boson is basically M Planck. So naturally, particles, scalar particles, want to have a mass scale that's of order the highest mass scale in your theory, which in this case is M Planck. So that's when quantum gravity starts. And then I just say, I don't know what happens. So it's a problem because, of course, the Higgs was never thought to have that mass. And if it did, the masses of all the particles, like the vector bosons and things, would also be huge, right? So the Higgs mechanism just wouldn't really work. So it's a problem because these corrections more or less screw up the Higgs mechanism. The explanation, nice explanation for the masses of all particles, which we know is now correct. So that's why it's phrased as a problem, and in that sense, it is a problem. And that problem has solutions. So the best example of the solution to that problem is supersymmetry. Now, whether or not that's really a solution to this problem for the Standard Model is actually under a lot of pressure from the fact that we haven't seen super partners yet at the LHC. And there are other ideas. So another idea is, well, maybe M Planck is really a TeV. So that would be this Randall-Sundrum idea where we live on a a membrane in some higher dimensional space. And the real scale of quantum gravity in that higher dimensional space is not M Planck 10 to the 19 GeV, but like a TeV. And then the corrections to the mass of the Higgs are much smaller. That idea, again, is also sort of becoming under increasing pressure from the LHC because we haven't seen evidence of these extra dimensions that are postulated to exist. And there's a third idea, which is sort of the craziest, but probably the most consistent. Maybe that's not fair, but you know, a consistent idea is that really this is true, but I told you that chemistry would not exist if there was not a hierarchy. And so maybe the universe is really big and there are places where the Higgs really does weigh M Planck, but by some fortuitous, unnatural cancellation in the part that we live in, it's not. You know, there's some big cancellation that gives us the Higgs mass that's in order what we see, 125 GeV. And so there's this this quote anthropic explanation in the context of the multiverse that is also maybe a plausible explanation for why there is this hierarchy. And I think that has to be, in my opinion at least, part of the story. Because there is no chemistry without a hierarchy. It just doesn't work. You need a hierarchy between the gravitational and the electromagnetic forces. Otherwise, the universe wouldn't look like it does. We wouldn't exist. We wouldn't be asking that question. So exactly how much of the story that is a point of controversy and an ongoing discussion, and we'll see. But the traditional ways of resolving this problem that the Higgs should have a mass that is of order M Planck, unless I introduce some new physics, you know, like supersymmetry or extra dimensions or something, all of the ideas that exist are under increasing pressure. So we need smart, young people like you to come up with better answers. You know, maybe it's a multiverse, or maybe there's some other way to get the mass of the Higgs to be what we think it is, or what we observe it to be, actually. Any other questions? Yeah?
So like here you mentioned about the alpha, which is very small, like 100, like 1 over 137.
Yeah,
and
for,
this is actually
you know,
a dimensionless constant.
Right.
So my question is that, is it possible that this kind of constant varies in time? So that, for example,
mm-hmm.
that initially comparable, so then
mm-hmm.
like they have different velocity of changing, so such that like this one becomes grows like decays much slower, so that they actually
mm-hmm.
around.
Certainly, that is a possibility. We do know something about the variation of the fine structure constant by looking at cosmological observations. So if we look at things that are really far away, they're also really far in the past. And it seems like the structure of atomic transitions, for example, looks the same for the farthest objects we can see as they do on Earth. And so you can constrain the variation of alpha in that way, at least on you know timescales of order a billion years, say. But in the very early universe, before nucleosynthesis and you know before a lot of the other things that we kind of know that you know alpha should be 137 for it to work out, that's a possibility. So just write a paper about your new idea for solving the hierarchy. but that's certainly an idea. Any other questions? Okay. So, now for something related but nearly totally different. So now let's talk about space-time and geometry. And the goal of this is basically to get to Einstein's equations and for you to understand the things that go into it and a few of the solutions to it. And I will leave a detailed discussion of all the details for your relativity course that you'll probably take in about a month. Okay. So let's talk about a few different ways that historically physicists have come up with to think about space and time. So we'll start with Newton. So Newton thought, of course, that space and time are absolute, meaning they're just a stage upon which the actors, particles, play, right? They don't influence the stage, they just act on it. So space and time are immutable, they're absolute. The consequence of that, of course, you know, sort of one consequence, for example, is that events are always simultaneous. Okay. So if we were to think about a space-time diagram, so there's t and there's x, and I consider two events. Say here we've got event A, and here we've got event B. Then if I have one observer, so here this of course is a world line, we'll call this observer one. So observer one is born sometime in the past, and he just sits here at some constant position. Then eventually, event A happens right on top of him, and then he continues on his merry way. So this would be one observer, and this observer is moving at a constant velocity, namely zero. So he, of course, is in an inertial frame. So inertial frames are reference frames that are four observers with a constant velocity. Now, but maybe there's some other observer. Let's say here I have some observer, observer number two, and he's traveling at some velocity v. So he's also in an inertial frame. And now I can ask, in the context of Newton, how are these different frames connected? Like, how would I describe physics according to, for example, observer two? So this is accomplished by Galilean transformations. So this is the way Newton transforms between inertial frames. And so what are the Galilean transformations? So if I were to go to another frame where observer two was at rest, then t doesn't change, right? So events are always simultaneous, time is absolute. If this is true, then in this new frame, event A and event B are still gonna happen at the same time. And if I ask how the positions changed, well, the position just changes in proportion to the velocity, right? So I just subtract off d times t. And so if we did that, we would basically just shift these lines, right? So observer one, two would be now traveling at a constant velocity, namely zero, and observer one would be traveling at a velocity negative v. Okay, and we can ask, how do velocities transform? So velocities transform as just dx dt minus v. So that's how I get observer two to be sitting at rest, because velocity is just transformed simply. They just add and subtract directly. So for Newton, there is an invariance, right? So what has to be true is that if I pick any two events, then the time interval between those two events is always the same. That's the consequence of t equals t prime. And the spatial interval between two events also has to be the same. And that's a consequence of my expression for x prime there, the fact that all positions get changed by a constant velocity times t. So spatial and time intervals between two events are separately invariant under the Galilean transformations. So of course what I mean by that is delta t, which is ta minus tb, is equal to delta t prime. So if I perform a Galilean transformation, I turn those t's into t primes, I get the same thing. That one's obvious. And if I ask about spatial transformations, then the spatial distance between two events, A and B, the spatial distance between two events, A and B, is also invariant under these Galilean transformations. And that's easy to see because each of these just gets added to it a minus B T. So it cancels out all these differences. Okay, so that's the world according to Newton. We can describe physics in any inertial frame we want by doing these Galilean transformations. So now let's ask, what is happening according to Einstein? So Einstein comes with a new insight that light travels, of course, at c equals 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second in all inertial frames. And the immediate consequence of that, you can see, is that the velocities cannot add like they do a la Galileo. Right? So if that was true, then I would just go to a different inertial frame, and then that would no longer be the speed of light. Okay, so something's got to break. And of course, the consequence of this is that space and time cannot be separate. So that means we can't have delta t equals delta t prime and delta r squared equals delta r squared prime. Okay, so those transformation laws for Newton cannot be right anymore because they imply a velocity law that doesn't. Okay, so the upshot is that the space-time interval is now the conserved quantity. And the space-time interval between two events is delta s squared minus c squared times delta t squared plus delta r squared. Okay, so this is the quantity now that we should try and conserve. We should figure out what the transformation law that conserves this quantity. So in pictures, now if we have a space-time diagram, there's x and there's t, and let's for just convenience sake put event A at the origin, so at t equals 0 is x equals 0. So from this space-time interval, one thing we can immediately see is that for things traveling at the speed of light, the space-time interval is 0. So if I had an event here, event B, we would say that event A and event B, well, they're on top of each other. They have zero space-time separation. And so things that have delta S squared equals 0 are null separated. So they're light-like separated. Okay, if I had an event here, event C. So here, if we evaluated delta S squared would be, less than 0. So the time part would win a spatial part. And so event A and event C would be time-like separated. And maybe I have an event over here, event D. Okay, so now here we have delta S squared would now be bigger than 0 because the spatial part wins over the time part when I'm in this quadrant. And these would be space-like separated events. And now we can just look at this and we can say, what other events would have the same delta S squared? And you can see that this is the equation for a hyperbola. So on this diagram, all events lying on this hyperbola would have the same time-like separation from the origin, and all events on this hyperbola would have the same space-like interval from this event at the origin. Okay? So the transformations that preserve delta S squared are transformations that just move us along these surfaces. Any transformation that would move us along these surfaces would preserve delta S squared. So if I were a good artist, we could think about at least a few of these things in pictures. Unfortunately, I'm not a very good artist. But I'll try one picture, at least to illustrate one thing. Okay, so if I were to draw some more dimensions, so if I were to add one dimension here, t, x, and y, I'd actually get it would be a surface. And on this surface here, we have this particular surface that I've drawn. If I have an event at the origin, here delta S squared would be bigger than 0. So these would be events that lie outside the light cone. So that's what we call this surface would be a light cone emanating from the origin. And so immediately, one thing you can see that would not change this surface would be rotations. Right? So I could do a rotation around the origin, no problem. That would preserve the space-time interval. So certainly part of what we're going to have is rotations. That's going to be something that's going to preserve delta S squared. And the other thing that's going to preserve delta S squared has got to intrinsically involve both space and time, because I need something that will just basically shift points along this surface, but not leave this surface. And those would be so-called boosts. Okay, so we can write that down. So preserved under rotations and boosts. And these, of course, are the Lorentz transformations. So to give an example of a boost, here we would take C times T prime. So to get T prime, we have the Lorentz gamma factor, Ct minus B over C times X. X prime would go to gamma X minus Vt. And if velocity was just in the x hat direction, so just in one direction, let's pick x, then the other ones would be preserved. Y and z would be preserved. Of course, you've all seen that before. These are, so this would be a Lorentz boost. And if I asked on this picture what that does, basically it would take points and then move them along this surface, maybe something like that. So just shift the points one direction to the other along. Okay, from this picture, so there are other simple things that we imagine, being invariant. So one thing would be like a translation, but you can see the translation can't be part of the Lorentz group. It can't preserve, it can't do this because then I'd shift the origin. So that would break. That's part of something else called the Fulcher group. So the natural language of special relativity is in terms of four vectors, which I'm sure you've seen before. So for example, the position four vector would be ct, x, y, z, just be a vector. Okay, in the same sense that you guys learned about tensors of different ranks, I'm assuming, from David's course. Did you talk about that? Yeah, good. So this is an example of a vector, simplest example of a vector. And so we could write the line element in terms of vectors and tensors. So delta S squared, the line interval. So this is a scalar. It's a scalar quantity. And how do I get a scalar quantity? So a vector is a rank 1, 0 tensor. So I need to multiply it by a rank 0, 2 tensor. So that's the map from vectors to scalars. Delta x nu. So in component notation, this is what we have. So this thing here is the metric, and these things here are just the four vector that expresses the difference in position and time between different things. Okay, so there's another way of writing that. So we could write that in terms of, instead of component notation, we could write this in terms of matrices. So equivalently, we could write delta S squared as delta X transpose. I guess here this would be, sort of matrix notation, this is actually the transpose, times eta times delta X, where eta is just a matrix with entries negative 1, 1, 1, and 0 everywhere else. And delta X is a vector with entry ct, delta c, delta t, delta x, delta y. Okay, so that's another way of writing it. And this matrix notation is useful because now we can think about deriving in a slightly more general way what exactly these Lorentz transformations are. So more specifically, Lorentz transformations are linear operations on delta x that leave the space-time interval delta s squared invariant. So by linear operation, of course, what I mean is that delta x prime is equal to some matrix, we'll call it lambda times delta x. Okay, so it's a linear operation that gives me a new delta x. And we can write this in terms of component notation as delta x nu prime equals lambda nu prime nu delta x nu. And so of course you all remember that in component notation, whenever you see a repeated index, you sum. So this is going to be a sum. And if I were to write this in terms of matrix notation, here we have a vector equals a 4x4 matrix times a vector. Right? So that would be the matrix way of representing these Lorentz transformations. Okay, so given that, so what conditions can we impose on lambda, the Lorentz transformations? So to see that, we can just look at the line interval. So that's again delta x, eta, delta x transpose, excuse me. And let's just do a Lorentz transformation now and show that it needs to meet certain conditions to get delta S squared to be invariant. So if we do a Lorentz transformation, then we get delta X prime transpose, and we need to stick in a lambda transpose times eta times lambda delta X prime. So here I've just substituted for delta x transpose and delta x in terms of what they should transform as. Or maybe these should be inverse because I've reversed prime and not prime, but it doesn't matter. Okay, so what should be true is that now I should be able to, if I'm going to get the same thing, if I'm going to get an invariant, then what should be true is that lambda transpose eta lambda should be equal to eta. So from this, it follows that we're really going to have an invariant quantity. I need eta to be equal to lambda transpose eta times lambda. And so that's something that you've seen before. Sorry, we'll come back in a second. So that's something you've seen before. Let's go back to one of the invariances that we knew was going to be true, and that was rotations. So in 2D, and in 2D because it's easier to write it down, not because I couldn't do 3D, but I just remember the one in 2D. The rotation matrix R, you'll remember, is cosine theta. I always forget where to put the minus sign. Negative sine theta, sine theta, cosine theta. And this rotation matrix has the property that if I take R transpose times the identity matrix times R, then I should get the identity matrix. And of course, if you follow that out and multiply the matrices, that just arises from the fact that we get a bunch of sine squared plus cosine squared, and those are one. So here, this rotation matrix has the same properties that we're looking for the Lorentz transformations, but now I just need to generalize this from rotations to include time. right? So we also, in addition to these spatial rotations, we need to include time. And of course, those are de Lorentz boosts. So basically, we generalize to include, we'll call it, quote, rotations in time. And those are the Lorentz boosts. And you can work out what those matrices are from formula that's on top of that board. Right, so we just need to figure out if x and t transform in that way, how do I represent that as a matrix? So that when I multiply delta x times that matrix, I get. And that, in a group theory sense, defines, so this defines a group. If I were to write down some commutation relations between these lambdas, then I get some relation that would tell me that anyway it's a group, but we'll leave that to later. And so this is going to include rotations. Of course, there's three in there. There's three different Euler angles, so three ways that I can have rotations, and three boosts. Okay. So that's six. And then, as I said before, the Poincaré group is something a little bit bigger. That the Poincaré group includes, so it's Lorentz plus space and time translations. And that, there's four of those, of course. So the fact that I get 3, 6, 10, so 3 plus 3 plus 4 equals 10 has some significance. So in four dimensions, 10 is the maximum number of symmetries that I can have, as it turns out. So for this reason, flat empty space of Newton is so-called maximally symmetric. And you'll learn a lot more about that when you talk about GR. But 10 is more or less a magic number. Actually, I'll tell you a little bit why 10 is a magic number, but probably not until next time. Okay. I haven't had any questions for a long time. Are there any questions? On a scale of 1 to 10, how comfortable are you with 5, because I can see your hands. On a scale of 1 to 5, raise your hands and tell me how comfortable you are with special relativity. Raise your hands and give me a number. 1 to 5. If you're 1 comfortable, you're not very comfortable. If you're 5 comfortable, you're super comfortable. 5, 4. Okay, excellent. So, I would encourage you to go back and solve a few problems, you know, like if I went back in time and killed my grandmother and this and that. Find a good book, or if you want to, I can actually give you some problems and we'll have the tutors post them on the web. And work out a few of these really basic special relativity problems. That's going to be something that's absolutely key to basically every course that you're going to take. Okay, that being said, any questions? Okay. So right, delta S squared is a scalar quantity. Okay. In the context of special relativity, we call it a Lorentz scalar. And by that we mean invariance under the Lorentz group. We'd also maybe call it a Lorentz invariant. the reason for that should be self-evident because it's invariant under Lorentz transformations. And of course, there are others. Okay, so for example, another one would be the mass of a particle. Right, so m squared c squared. So m squared c squared is given by multiplying the four momentum times eta times p. Okay, so in components, that's eta mu nu, e nu, e nu, where the four momentum, just to remind you, it is e over c times the components of the momentum. Okay, so that's the rest mass of a particle, where E includes both M, that includes the rest mass, and kinetic energy, right? So both are in there. Okay, so that's another Lorentz invariant. There are many Lorentz invariants. Basically, anything where you sop up all the indices, so anything where everything is contracted, is a Lorentz invariant. Lorentz invariants are great because if I can compute thing in one frame, I can know what it is in every other frame by performing Lorentz transformations, and that's extraordinarily convenient. So I'm sure you guys talked in David's course about scalars, vectors, tensors, right? So again, this is sort of a similar thing. It's not exactly the same thing because this is only at this level. These things are scalars under Lorentz transformations, right? Whereas for a tensor, it's a little more general. We'll talk about that in a second. Okay. So special relativity is basically the theory of Lorentz invariants, and the theory of Lorentz invariants says that physics should be Lorentz invariant. That is the same in all inertial frames, right? Because that's what we invented this to do. So a la Newton, the Galilean transformations took us between inertial frames. A la Einstein, Lorentz transformations take us between inertial frames. So this thing, this statement, can be generalized. So that's special relativity. General relativity, we can summarize in some sense as physics should be diffeomorphism invariant. Diffeomorphisms are just general coordinate transformations. So this general relativity basically says that is the same in all coordinate systems. Okay, so that's the generalization. Is we're now going to not only think about Lorentz transformations, but we're going to think about general coordinate transformations, which are known as diffeomorphisms. Okay. So now we can proceed in a similar sense to what we did for special relativity. We can define diffeomorphisms. Sometimes probably people will be lazy and call these diffs. That's what they mean. It's a isomorphism. So this is a linear operation, just like the Lorentz transformations, which we can write, for example, if we have the position 4 vector, then a diffeomorphism would be a 2x2 matrix, or a 4x4 matrix, excuse me, that we can write in this way. We write it in this way because secretly, I guess you guys probably from David talked about basis elements or forms and vectors, right? So this notation derives from that. But we can cheat, and you know, like this actually you can think of, if I have some coordinate system x mu prime and some other coordinate system x mu, if I know one set of coordinates in terms of the other, I can just interpret this as a matrix of a bunch of partial derivatives. So really all I need to know is what some set of coordinates are in terms of another, and then applying tensors in a way that makes mathematicians cringe, but relativists don't care, you can just interpret this as a bunch of partial derivatives. Okay, so that's how I would do a general diff on a vector. And more generally, we can perform diffs on an arbitrary tensor, so a rank Ln tensor. To give another example, and the trick, it's really easy. I just apply partial derivatives with the right primes in the right places to sop up all the indices. Right? So here, mu and mu are contracted, and I'm left with mu prime. So that's the thing I have on the left side. So just for practice, we could look at a rank 2-2 tensor. T mu prime, rho prime, sigma prime. And now this is going to be a bunch of linear operations on T mu, nu, rho, sigma. And now I just need to sop up all the indices. So I'll have a mu prime on top and a mu on bottom. And I'll have a mu prime on top and a mu on the bottom. And then now I've got a prime on the bottom, and I should get a unprime on the top. So dx rho prime, and dx sigma prime. Okay, so that's how I would perform a general diff for a general coordinate transformation on this tensor here. So this procedure is known as the tensor transformation law. So I just am applying a sequence of linear operations on a tensor, and that's how I change coordinates. You could think in some sense that this law, if the quantity transforms in this way, then that kind of defines what you mean by a tensor. So for example, not all 4-index objects transform in this manner. I can imagine they transform differently. And then that 4-index object, well, it'd be a 4-index object, but it wouldn't really be a tensor. Okay, so that's the tensor transformation law. And now, just sort of by analogy, with special relativity, we can require that sort of something similar to the space-time interval, but we'll actually call it the metric. We can require that the metric is invariant under diffeomorphism. So the metric, we'll write it as ds squared. And again, this derives from sort of the notion that uh, here we have a rank 0, 2 tensor. That's G mu nu. That's also called a metric. And these, if we were going to be super anal about our tensors, then these are really the basis elements, right? So remember, dx mu, dx nu are the basis elements that I need for a 0, 2 tensor. If it was a 2, 0 tensor, then these would need to be partial derivatives. Those are the basis elements for a 2, 0 tensor. But again, in a way that would make mathematicians cringe, but relativists are perfectly comfortable with, you forget about that, and you interpret this as some 4 by 4 matrix, and these as like literally differentials. Okay. So, I don't know, to give you an example of how we cheat, which is nevertheless perfectly mathematically fine, but you just don't write down these steps. We could generalize the space-time interval from special relativity, which is just the metric for flat, empty space. Well, that would be just negative dc squared dt squared plus dx squared dy squared dz squared. In other words, I have a metric that the dx's would be c dt, dx, dy, dz. I'd have a metric, g mu nu, that was negative 1, 1, 1, 1, 0 everywhere else. And then, sorry, that should actually be the transpose. So that would look more something like this. Times c dt, dx, dy, dz. If I multiply it out, I'll get my thought. So this was g mu nu here. And so that's what I have. So now we could look at like a null ray, okay? So a null ray in the x direction. Passing 2 points. So if I had a space-time diagram, t and x, I just have point 1 and point 2. And I want to measure the space-time interval between these. Then, of course, I know ds squared is 0. So for this example, we have 0 is minus c dt squared plus dx squared. And then dy squared dz squared are 0 because it doesn't move. There's no distance between these two events in x and y. And now I can completely abuse this notation. Sorry, that's c squared. Now I can completely abuse this notation. And first thing, maybe I'll put the c squared on one side. And then I've got c squared, dt squared is dx squared. And then I'll take the square root of both sides. And I'll get rid of these squares. And then I can put the dt squared in the denominator. And see that dx dt is equal to c. Okay, so the speed of light is c. And again, feel free to abuse this notation. You should at some point see how this really works with tensors, which you might see in your general relativity course, but I think it's beyond the scope of these three lectures. You know, this procedure is actually mathematically well-defined. And even though these are really like basis elements for a 0, 2 tensor, it's okay for you to completely abuse the notation and do this. So I give you permission. Abuse this notation, treat these like differentials, and just make your life easy, and don't write out 50 steps to show that, well, really a 0, 2 tensor has these basis elements. If I do these operations, I get to be. Just abuse the notation. Totally fine. Okay, so now we can go back to this thing here. The definition of what I mean by a tensor is that it obeys the tensor transformation law. That is, it is invariant under diffeomorphisms. So, sort of by definition, the space-time metric Well, that's a tensor, and all tensors are invariant under dips, right? So they all obey this transformation law. So we're guaranteed that this thing we call ds squared is really a scalar. So, like in a true sense. And so by definition, more or less by definition, this thing here, the metric, is invariant under dips. So this is a central quantity in general relativity because it tells us how sort of the interval between events is really kind of doesn't matter what coordinate system you use. It's always the same because it's invariant under these linear operations. Invariant under dips. Okay, so I think probably I'll call it quits there. And then we'll pick up next time, and I will show you what gravity has to do with geometry. So here we've more or less just talked about, again, like the stage, right, where we have a background, this metric that tells us how to judge the interval between events in the generalized sense that we did in special relativity. But we actually don't know what this has to do with gravity yet. So I'll explain what this has to do with gravity. So before we end, are there any questions about what I've shown you today? How many of you calculated your age, weight, and height in terms of GEV? Okay, excellent. How old are you in GEV?
I guess Wolf Kalafa has this really easy thing. We just put in like 80 GeV.
Okay.
Just big deal.
Yeah. And you should do it. Just get practice. You'll have to do other harder things. I'm giving you something really easy to do inside. No one else will do that. Enjoy. So anyway, if there are no questions, then we'll be back here again tomorrow, and that'll be your last semester. And I'll tell you what this has to do with gravity.